in the middle of the dark Swedish October night, 1899. Near Johannes Hughes station, Mr. Velin lay asleep in his large house. Around 2 a.m., Velin and his household were awakened by knocking on the door. Outside stood a young man, wounded and covered in blood. He introduced himself as Theodor Solrut, and he reported that there was a commotion at the station. He explained that a bookkeeper named Larsen had stabbed him, and that he now was in the process of killing his colleague and friend, Ernst Cederberg. While they hurried towards the station, Velin asked Theodor where they could find his friend. But Theodor Solrut only gave vague and contradictory information. When they arrived at the station, they found the doors locked, so they entered through a broken window. Inside the station, everything was in disarray. A lamp was broken, but with the light still burning. The matchbox beside it was smeared with blood. On the table there were two drinking glasses. A safe stood open, and there was blood everywhere. Suddenly, Velin's dog began to bark outside the station house. So they climbed back out through the broken window. And a short walk away, on a field near the station, lay a man. Clearly dead. It was Ernst Cederberg, Theodor Solrut's friend. There was no one else around, and the man in front of them had clearly been dead for a while. Velin instantly understood that something wasn't right. He asked Solrut, "How does this make sense? You say that Cederberg and Larsen were fighting, and that you don't know where Cederberg is, yet when we find him just minutes later, he's dead, cold and stiff." To this, Solrut only replied, "It was an unfortunate day. I've been misled all day." Theodor Solrut was born in 1879 as the third of four children of Lars Persson Solrut and his wife Bengta. The family established themselves in the small city of Fjällkingay in the south of Sweden, where Theodor's father started a general store. Over time, the home became quite prosperous. The family belonged to the Baptist congregation, and religion was important in the Solrut household. In February 1896, the now 17-year-old Theodor Solrut applied and was accepted as a student at the Middelblekinge Railway. After 2 years as an apprentice, he moved on to become a station clerk at the Braid Ockra station. His first salary was 50 kroner a month, which was not much, especially for someone who was used to the support of a relatively wealthy home. Theodor lived in the modern town of Ronneby at this time, and despite his low income, he led an outgoing life. He stayed up to date with the latest fashion trends and spent money on clothes and entertainment. Money soon began to become a problem. And so it was that one day, when Theodor was alone at the station, he discovered money in an envelope addressed to the traffic manager. He pocketed the 361 kroner found in the envelope. But the theft was discovered and soon reported to the county police. Oscar Waldau, the county constable and a meticulous man, carefully interrogated all the employees at the station. Theodor Solrut played along and pretended he knew nothing about the theft, and it must have worked as he didn't get caught. However, the atmosphere among the employees at the station quickly became tense as they began to suspect one another. It didn't take long for it to happen again. This time, Theodor stole 251 kroner from the station. This theft also went unsolved. In early September 1899, Theodor took an 8-day pleasure trip to Copenhagen and Berlin. He had received money for the trip from his father, but had also taken loans. Additionally, Theodor worked extra to sell private insurance for an insurance company. Now, he delayed accounting for the sold policies and borrowed from his customers money for travel, entertainment, and living expenses. When he returned from his trip, he had several hundred kroner in debts. Shortly after his pleasure trip, Theodor was transferred from the railway station in Braid Ockra to the station in Johannes Hughes. In September, station master Ernst Cederberg also arrived at the same station. He was 2 years younger than Theodor and born in the same area in southern Sweden. The two became friends and got along well, despite being quite different. Ernst Cederberg was tall, sturdily built, with fair hair, a calm, listening, and ambitious young man. Meanwhile, Theodor Sollroot was restless in temperament and mind. He had a vivid imagination and enjoyed talking and philosophizing. He was also significantly smaller in stature than Ernst. Theodor and Ernst soon began staying late after work. They often ate and chatted together before cycling home to Ronneby, just over 10 kilometers away. And it was during such a night, in early October 1899, that Ernst Cederberg mentioned that later in the week he would receive the monthly remittance. The expected amount should be close to 1,000 kroner. Theodor immediately knew that this was enough money to solve all his problems. Over the following days, the plan took shape. No matter the cost, Sollroot would take the money, even if it meant killing his friend. The following story is Theodor Sollroot's version of events, as later recounted by a local newspaper and now translated into English for this podcast. On the morning of Friday, October 6th, Theodor Sollroot bought cartridges for his revolver. At 9:30 in the evening, Theodor cycled to Johannes Hughes. Armed with a revolver, a razor blade, and a fist-sized stone wrapped in a handkerchief, he left his bicycle by a nearby church to avoid detection. It was 11:20 when he arrived at Cederberg's place, where Ernst was busy writing. Theodor explained his late visit by saying that he had broken his bicycle. Cederberg brought out something for them to drink, and they sat down and talked. Sollroot drank 3 rounds, a quarter glass each time. Cederberg drank too, but only a little. While engaging in pleasant conversation, Theodor discreetly picked up a bundle wrapped in a handkerchief, readying himself to put his plan into action. Suddenly, and in the middle of the conversation, he unexpectedly took out the stone and struck Ernst Cederberg in the forehead. Cederberg screamed and got up from his chair by the table, only to immediately fall onto a bed. Sollroot was quickly over him and continued to strike him with the stone. Cederberg desperately tried to block the blows with his hands, but it was in vain as the hits kept landing. Somehow, Cederberg then managed to stand up and turned towards Sollroot. Sollroot took out his razor blade and slashed Cederberg across the neck. But Cederberg managed to grab the razor from Sollroot, breaking it, so that only the handle remained in Sollroot's hand. Cederberg now tried to defend himself, using the razor blade. He aimed a couple of cuts at Sollroot, who blocked them with his arm. Cederberg then turned and ran, past the office and into the waiting room. Sollroot now took out his revolver. He went after his victim and fired shots at Cederberg. Somehow, Cederberg was still standing. He turned and ran towards his room, followed by Sollroot. Cederberg now tried at grabbing the gun again, and this time he managed to wrest the revolver from Sollroot's hand. Cederberg then rushed towards a window, broke it, jumped outside and ran, but Sollroot followed him. Cederberg cried in distress while trying to flee. He fell down, but got up again. But it gave Sollroot enough time to catch up and attack his victim again. They ended up wrestling, during which Sollroot managed to take the razor blade from Cederberg, who by now was greatly weakened by his injuries. Sollroot aimed his stabs at Cederberg's head and neck, but Cederberg simply refused to give up. They wrestled their way to a nearby potato field. Here, Cederberg fell again, tried to get up, and as he got up, he shouted, "Don't kill me." But Sollroot wasn't about to stop. He picked up a stone from the ground and threw it at his victim. Then he threw himself over Cederberg and, having lost the razor blade, managed to find a penknife. Cederberg, now realizing his end was near, asked Sollroot for forgiveness for anything he might have done to him. Cederberg also asked Solroot to send his regards to Cederberg's parents. Solroot then cut his throat with the penknife. Finally, Ernst Cederberg lay still. Solroot got up and threw the penknife into a well. He went back to the station house, entering through the broken window into Cederberg's room. He found the keys in the pocket of a coat hanging by the bed. He then opened the safe, seeking the money that was the entire reason for this brutal murder. All he found was 330 kroner. He had intended to flee, but realized he was too injured. So he came up with a story about another killer, bookkeeper Larsen. He went outside again and used matches to look for the revolver. He saw Cederberg, who was clearly dead. He then hid the money and went to the well to wash up. But he couldn't get any water as he couldn't get the bucket working. He then went to Merchant Velin's house and woke them up. He was let in, had his wounds cleaned, and told the fabricated story about Larsen. After discovering the body of Cederberg, Solroot, Velin, and Velin's lodger all helped carry the body into the station's woodshed. Velin then arranged transport for Solroot back to Ronneby, and on the way they stopped to report the incident to the police, more specifically to the County Constable Carl Halden. County Constable Halden was a man in his 50s with 4 children. He inquired Theodore Solroot about what had happened. Meanwhile, Constable Halden walked to Johannes Hughes station and the crime scene. Later that day, Constable Halden questioned Theodore Solroot once more, this time in Solroot's apartment in Ronneby. It stood clear that his story didn't add up. The constable decided to arrest Solroot, who was taken to the county jail in Karlskrona. Theodore's father accompanied him during the transport, and it might have been under his father's influence that Solroot soon began to confess. The media quickly picked up on the story, sparking widespread public interest in the days that followed. At the time, the media was still in its youth, with limited ethics and regulations. This meant that every detail that could be gathered about the events was published on the very next day in newspapers around the country. One reporter went as far as to visit the woodshed where the body lay and reported, quote, "During the visitor's inspection today, the body was found in a woodshed. The head was nearly severed by the knife wound and otherwise horribly mutilated," end quote. However, amid the detailed reporting, some articles expressed concerns over the rising crime rates in Sweden. Here follows an excerpt from one of those newspaper articles. Crime and upbringing. Across Sweden, people could read about the horrifying murder of the young station master in Johannes Hughes. This crime has naturally led to thoughts about the many other shocking crimes recently committed in our country, which led the Norwegians to make the rude and unjust claim in a northern Swedish newspaper that the Swede, like his kinsman, the Italian, is born a criminal. It is bad enough as it is, without condemning the entire Swedish nation. However, we must ask ourselves how we can address such degeneration. End quote. People all across Sweden were concerned about how they seemed to read about horrible crimes more and more often in the newspapers. On October 20th, a trial was held before the Medelsta District Court. The trial for the murder of Station Inspector E. Cederberg at Johannes Hughes Station and the detained Theodore Solroot. The prosecutor was County Constable Halden. The courtroom was packed to max capacity with spectators. The prosecutor demanded that Solroot be held accountable for the murder of Cederberg and the theft of 880 kroner. And let's pause here for a second, for a side note, that the newspaper reports are not consistent about how much money was actually stolen. While listening to this story, take into consideration that newspapers' credibility from the end of the 19th century should be considered not very credible. End of side note. Solroot openly confessed that it had been his intention to steal the money and to murder Cederberg to achieve this goal, and that his intentions had then been to flee. Distressed but composed, he answered the chairman's questions in a low voice. "Did you not feel sorry for Cederberg? I don't know what I was thinking. Did you not think of your parents?" "No. But you love your parents, don't you? And you wouldn't want to hurt those you love. I thought it would remain a secret. When did you come up with the idea to commit the crime?" "A couple of days before." The trial lasted for 2 weeks, and the court's verdict was reported in the local newspapers, emphasizing that no mitigating circumstances existed. Prosecutor Haldin demanded that Solrut be sentenced to death for the murder. "Considering all the recent violent crimes throughout our country," he argued, "that sparing Solrut from the death penalty would significantly increase insecurity for the citizens of Sweden." Additionally, Solrut was charged with theft. Solrut admitted he deserved the death penalty, but pleaded for the lightest possible sentence. After a brief deliberation, the court sentenced Solrut to life in penal labor and perpetual dishonor. He received the sentence quite calmly. After announcing the verdict, the judge addressed Solrut, stating that the court believed the crime deserved the death penalty, but given the offender's youth, opted for a life sentence of penal labor. The verdict, however, was to be reviewed by the Court of Appeal, and less than 2 months later, the case was heard in the Court of Appeal. And this time, Solrut was not as lucky. And on the second to last day of the 19th century, the newspaper reported, "Theodor Julius Solrut, for the murder of Ernst Cederberg, combined with robbery and theft, has been sentenced to death by beheading." And it's now time for another side note. A death sentence at this time and age in Sweden did not necessarily mean that Solrut would be executed. In fact, when this verdict was delivered, it had been 7 years since the last execution in Sweden, reflecting a growing public resistance to the death penalty. Several people had been sentenced to death during this period, but all had been pardoned after petitioning the king for mercy. In fact, in an interview in the newspaper, a few months earlier, Sweden's only remaining executioner, Anders Gustav Dahlman, was asked, "Why have you left the blood of the executed pair Johan Pettersson from 1893 on the axe?" Executioner Dahlman had replied, "Yes, I'll tell you, sir. Professor Fritjof Holmgren, who was present at the execution in Gävle, said to me, 'Leave the blood on your axe, as it is likely the last time that axe will be used in Sweden.' And since then, I have let the blood remain." And so it was that in the spring of the year 1900, Theodor Solrut submitted a humble petition to His Majesty the King to be spared the death penalty and to have his sentence transformed to life in penal labor. Given that all those sentenced to death in recent years had been granted mercy, and considering Solrut's youth, it seemed likely that he would be pardoned. Months passed while Solrut awaited the decision on his mercy petition. But then, on May 17, 1900, something happened. One of the most shocking crimes in Sweden's history occurred.
Johan Philip Nordlund committed a mass murder aboard the steamboat Prins Carl on the lake Mälaren.
And it wasn't just a shocking crime. It was also a widely reported crime. As media and newspapers blossomed in the early 20th century, the people of Sweden had likely never before experienced the mass media impact that followed such a horrific event. Newspapers printed extra editions, one after another, and it had a huge impact on the public. And even though it's just speculation, it is likely that this had an effect on what happened next. Because when the Royal Majesty, shortly thereafter, reviewed Solrut's mercy petition, the king himself, Oscar II, was abroad. The decision was signed in his absence by Crown Prince Gustav, later known as Gustav V. Theodore Solrut was not pardoned. The story that follows is from the memoirs of Ulrich Leander, the prison director of the Karlskrona prison, where Theodore Solrut was held captive and where he soon were to be executed, Ulrich writes. The outcome of this case was likely influenced significantly by the fact that both the so-called Loderup murderer and the mass murderer, Nordlund, committed their heinous acts around the same time. It was deemed inappropriate to make an exception for Solrut and subject him to the same fate as the other two, who paid for their crimes with death. It has been said that public opinion is as fickle as the winds. This truth can be seen in many areas, but especially in the changing attitudes towards serious criminals. In the first days after a murder or a heinous act, hatred for the perpetrator flares up, and people are ready to lynch him. But before you know it, the vengeful feelings have turned into something akin to sympathy and compassion. This happens particularly in cases where the criminal is young and possesses some appealing quality, as was the case with Solrut. Especially after the death sentence was confirmed, letters of support and encouragement came to him from both known and unknown individuals, and the number of women who came and requested to speak with him, or at least send him flowers, was quite large. To be part of deciding when a person's life thread shall be cut is most serious, not to say dreadful. The authorities with the power to make this decision had determined that Solrut's head should fall by the axe. That decision could not be changed. However, they had not decided when this would take place. That decision was left to the county administration, which naturally wanted to consult with the prison director, me, regarding the most suitable time for the execution. I clearly remember the occasion when I visited the county secretary to propose the date for the execution. It was set for July 5th, 1900, early in the morning. When I left after this meeting, I felt a certain dread on my way home. I felt as if I had participated in taking away the power from him who gave us life, and to whom alone it belongs to take it back when he sees fit. However, I had done nothing more than express my opinion on the most suitable day for carrying out an act that I had no power to prevent. But from that day on, my stance on the death penalty was fully clear. Solrut initially endured a difficult struggle in prison. When he had the chance to reflect on his past life, and especially his last act, he experienced such anxiety and horror that he could be said to illustrate what David felt and experienced when he said in one of his psalms that his bones wasted away and his vitality was dried up as by the heat of summer. A guilty conscience grants no sweet days. The deed was done and could not be undone, even if Solrut wished 1,000 times that it had never happened. But could he, and everything that he had done, be forgiven? Solrut found that through diligently reading the Bible, which he had studied in his childhood but which he had since forgotten, he gradually dared to believe that God would erase his sin and guilt. This certainty brought him peace and a clear conscience. And thereafter he faced with remarkable courage the day when the death sentence would be carried out. Let's pause reading the memoirs of Ulrich Leander and visit the fact that during his time in prison, Solrut wrote several letters. One of them is preserved at the Swedish Prison Museum. Here follows a translation. Karlskrona, July 1900. Mr. Sergeant P. Christensen, the wages of sin is death, but God's gift is eternal life in Christ Jesus our Lord. Should my death come today, I shall not be afraid, for my Jesus fulfilled the law in my place. What a friend! The power of death is thus crushed. It can no longer harm me. I am redeemed by Christ. No one can condemn me. As I shall leave this earthly life in a few hours, I want to take this opportunity to thank you most heartily for all the services and sacrifices made on my behalf. I also ask that you convey to your wife my most respectful and heartfelt thanks for everything she has done for me. Forgive me, too, if I have not conducted myself as I should. Soon my body will rest in the grave. Soon, through God's great mercy, my spirit, cleansed by the blood that purifies from all, even blood-red sins, free from all earthly ties and sorrows, saved and happy, will ascend to God. My deepest wish is to meet you in heaven with God. God bless and keep you and your family for eternal life. A heartfelt farewell, humbly and submissively, T.J. Solroot. It's relevant to know that even though the date was set for the execution, Solroot himself did not know which day it would happen. However, he knew that his parents were coming to visit him on July 4th, and could therefore guess that his execution was imminent. We continue now from Ulrich Leander's point of view. But it was not until they arrived, around noon on July 4th, that they and Solroot himself learned that the execution would take place early the next morning. Considering the calm with which Solroot had received the death sentence and awaited its execution, it was certainly not risky to let him know the time of the execution earlier. Nevertheless, it was deemed best to delay this information as long as possible. Above all, it was important to keep the time hidden from the public, who had no business in the matter. But might, out of a thirst for sensation, cause some inconvenience if they learned the time when Solroot's head was to fall. However, it was not an easy task. The execution had to be preceded by certain preparations that could not easily be concealed from those who sought to uncover the timing of the unusual event. Certain authorities, who were to appoint representatives to attend the execution, had to be informed in advance, as did the medical faculty in Lund, in case they wished to send some of their members to make scientific observations. Most importantly, the executioner, Anders Gustav Dahlman, from Stockholm, had to know when he was to perform his duty. So when he had arrived the previous morning, accompanied by his son as an assistant, it was reported that the executioner with his large axe had been seen on the train and had immediately gone to the prison from the station, it was easy to guess that the execution was imminent. However, even before that, in the public imagination, Solroot had lost his head several times. Many had seen a black flag raised on the prison's roof as a sign that Dahlman's axe had been at work. Solroot's parents stayed with him all afternoon the day before his death. The farewell at 7 in the evening was understandably emotional and sensitive. The night then passed quietly and peacefully for Solroot. The rest of us were undoubtedly much more restless than he was. For a couple of hours in the evening, the prison chaplain, Pastor Nils Thoren, stayed with him in the cell. Afterward, I stayed with him for the rest of the night. Between 12 and 3, he slept quite well, it seemed, and would probably have slept even longer if I hadn't woken him. The time for departure was approaching, and he needed time for his last morning prayer and to get ready. And even if the public had managed to guess the day of the execution, the hour could still be kept secret. A rumor had spread that the execution would take place at 8 in the morning. How this rumor started, or who spread it, was never determined. The prison administration considered it unnecessary to investigate, as the person who started the rumor had done them a favor. So when Solroot met his fate, just after sunrise on July 5th, 1900, most of Karlskrona's residents and the visitors in the city remained in their beds. Down in the prison yard, everything was prepared. The scaffold consisted of a couple of planks resting on sand, serving as a floor. On top of this, at one end, the actual chopping block was placed. Dahlman had this made in Stockholm and brought it with him. When those who were to witness the execution gathered in the early morning in the prison yard, and the Royal Majesty's verdict was read aloud, Solroot was brought out of his cell. It was noticed that he was pale, but he showed no particular anxiety and maintained his usual calm. He bid farewell to Sergeant Christensen and the present warders by shaking their hands and thanking them for their kindness toward him. He then walked steadily through the prison corridor with Pastor Thorin on one side and me on the other, over to the place where the scaffold was set up. Here he took off his coat and vest and knelt in a short prayer, thanking God, who, despite his great sinfulness, had not rejected him but shown him mercy and forgiveness. After finally entrusting his spirit into the hands of the Heavenly Father, he bared his neck by pulling down his shirt and bent his head voluntarily, trying to place his face in the indentation, made for that purpose, in the chopping block. Meanwhile, the executioner, who had kept himself hidden in a shed, approached. Since Solrut had laid himself a bit too low, I advised him to move a bit higher. When his shirt then slid up on his neck, I folded it down and positioned him correctly by holding his shoulders. When I then lifted my eyes, I saw the polished axe blade gleaming in the sunlight, and at that moment the blow fell, instantly separating the head from the body. No one had expected it to happen so quickly, and surely the procedure was much shorter and perhaps even simpler for Solrut himself than he had imagined. A few seconds after the blow, his lips were still seen moving, as if continuing the prayer that surely passed over them the moment Solrut crossed the boundary between the temporal and eternal worlds. When Dalman completed his task, he stood motionless for a moment, looking upwards. After putting down the axe, he turned away and wiped the tears from his cheeks with his handkerchief. He was heard to say something about the pity of having to shorten the life of such a young and submissive person. After regaining control of his emotions, he turned to me and said, still visibly moved, "Imagine if it had been my own son who had to meet such a fate. The profession had not made Dalman heartless. Instead, he showed a considerable softness of heart." After the two doctors from Lund had autopsied the body and collected certain parts for scientific purposes, their janitor, Cato, offered to arrange the dressing of the deceased. Once he received help placing the body in the coffin, he completed his task so thoroughly that anyone unaware of the manner of death would have assumed upon seeing the deceased that he had died a natural death. After carefully washing away the blood, he stitched the head to the torso with a few stitches. At around 10 o'clock in the morning, there was a burial service by the prison chaplain. When the body was transported from the prison to the chapel, a considerable number of people lined the streets. Everything proceeded calmly. After the burial service, the coffin was taken directly to the railway carriage that would transport the body to Jael Kinge. Solrut's parents accompanied the train, and along the entire route, flags were flown at half-mast at the stations. When they arrived, the deceased was interred with great ceremony. The death penalty in peacetime was abolished in Sweden in 1921. By then, Ulrich Leander had become a member of parliament and was involved in pushing through the abolition. Ulrich wrote in his memoirs, "When I later participated in the parliamentary decision to abolish this punishment, I felt great satisfaction." Last side note, reading newspaper articles about Solrut give the impression that crime was on the rise in Sweden in the late 1890s. But is this true? Let's first look at theft crimes. Around 1840, the figure was about 100 per 100,000 inhabitants. By 1900, theft crimes had decreased to about 30 per 100,000 inhabitants per year. If we look at murders and manslaughter, the figures are about 1.7 per 100,000 in the mid-1800s, and about 1 per 100,000 inhabitants in 1900. So, portrayal of crime in the newspapers seems to follow a different logic than the actual crime rates. Murder Ballads is a podcast about horrific true crimes from the 18th, 19th, and early 20th centuries. The main source material for this podcast is original newspaper articles and trial protocols, but also from old songs that were written, sold, and sung by the people of this day and age who love true crime as much as you and I. If you like this podcast, please leave a comment, as it would greatly help in reaching a wider audience. Thank you for listening.